Steve. 1, 2, 3. No. Oh, that's because I always forget to do this.
Good evening. Good evening. Do you know, Bishop Chris, this is such a testament to how much we love to hear what you have to say, because it's nasty out there. And here we are. Or it's about the cake.
It's about the cake.
I'm pretty sure it's about you. But thank you so much. We were a ministry team about 2.5 months ago, and trying to think, what can we do with good purpose in the benefice to prepare us for Christmas, to draw us all through Advent? And we've all been aware that we're a little bit short-staffed at the moment, and we don't think that's going to carry on for much longer. But we wanted to do something of high quality that would sustain us and draw us together, perhaps in a way we haven't been drawn. And we thought, what better way to just take a look at how we read these Old Testament passages that we are all going to come across, whichever church we're going to on a Sunday, if we can be at the Advent procession, and if we're not anywhere, we've got them all here. And hopefully this will just encourage us to go deeper in our faith and in our journey together towards Christmas. And of course we thought, who better to do this but Bishop Chris? And it wasn't anything like he wasn't there, you know. But it wasn't, because we're just all curious to hear how you're going to lead us. So I just, well, we're all so grateful to you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Tutor Sandy. If any of you were here this morning, and most of you were, you'll know that we had an absolutely amazing service, just utterly wonderful. Choir, just superb. Don't know where the chaplain is. Luke, where are you? Luke was superb with the chaplain. It was all wonderful. But thank you to Sandy for making that all happen. It was just astonishing. So, Sandy, thank you to you for inviting me to talk about the Old Testament. I had a feeling it was a Freudian slip on your part, actually. It's the word old that appealed to you. Who do I know? Oh, I know, you'll do. That old man.
Never.
Anyway, tall order to talk about and discuss and provide information about the Old Testament in about 45 minutes. So, I'm not going to begin with theology as such. I'm not going to do that initially. I want to talk about the four main concepts which thread their way through the Old Testament from the first book in the Old Testament, Genesis, to Malachi the last. So, what are the four concepts? This is kind of about the history of ideas, which I love. So there are four concepts that interlock and weave their way through the narrative. First, you won't be surprised to know, is the concept of God. And God is seen as the creator, the one who brought and brings everything into being, animals, birds, reptiles, and the entire landscape. So here's part of Psalm 104. You'll know it. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with honor and majesty. Wrapped in light as with a garment, you stretch out the heavens like a tent. You set the beams of your chambers on the waters. You make the clouds your chariot. You ride on the wings of the wind. You make the winds your messengers, fire and flame your ministers. You set the earth on its foundations so that it shall never be shaken. O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Now that's a beautiful psalm. No one is absolutely certain that it was originally written. Possibly round about the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC. I'll say more of that later. There are some people who attribute it directly to King David, in which case it will have been written about 1000 BC. So the concept of God is key. And the God who is seen as creator is seen as one, dominant above all other gods, King of kings, Lord of lords. So here, for instance, is Deuteronomy 4:35. I quote, "To you it was shown so that you would acknowledge that the Lord is God. There is no other besides him." Now, technically, that, as you know, is monotheism. So in Judaism, there are not loads of gods, as there are in the Greek and Roman myths, like Zeus or Mars or Aphrodite. Not loads of gods like in the Egyptian mythologies, gods like Anubis, the one who watched over graves, or Horus, the god of kingship and the sun and healing. Not like the Babylonian gods, such as Marduk, a kind of sun god with his parents, Enki, and the creation god, and Damgalnuna, his wife. None of that. So surrounding the people of Israel were all these other large groups of people, all of whom had loads of gods. And the Jewish people said, no, there is one. That's extraordinary. Extraordinary. In fact, what we need to note is that there were several names for God in the Old Testament. Yahweh used to be called Jehovah in the Old King James Version, for instance. What does the word Yahweh mean? Answer, it probably means, quotes, "He brings into existence all that exists." It's a wonderful name. And it comes from the Hebrew verb to be. Which point I need to point out, that in Hebrew there are no vowels. So in Hebrew, Yahweh is spelled Y, if you transliterate it into English, is Y-H-W-H, I am that I am, or I will be what I will be, that's Yahweh. Elohim is another name for God, which has been strong and mighty, and Adonai, powerful ruler. If you know the Leonard Bernstein Church's Chichester Psalms, you'll remember that Adonai, which is a very significant part of those Psalms. So, just want to recap. The first and dominant concept in the Old Testament is God as creator, and God as one. No other gods, just Yahweh. So the second dominant concept is that of the Jews as the chosen people, the Hebrews, chosen by God, having a unique covenantal relationship with him. In other words, a relationship of absolute promise. So, Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 6, "For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on earth to be his people, his treasured possession." But there's a caveat about obeying the law. The chosen people are required to keep the laws which God gave them through Moses. You and I know them as the Ten Commandments. God spoke all these words and said, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods but me. You shall not make for yourself an idol," etc., etc., etc. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And in addition to keeping the law, the chosen people have an obligation to confess their sins and faults and to restore any breaks that they have in their relationship with God. How do they do this? By offering specific animal or cereal, C-E-R-E-A-L, cereal sacrifices. For instance, remembering Passover. "These are the appointed festivals of the Lord," this is Leviticus chapter 23, "that you shall celebrate at the time appointed for them. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at twilight, there shall be a Passover offering to the Lord." Remember, that's a lamb that's sacrificed. So, creator God, chosen people, third concept coming up, the land. According to the Old Testament, All of this is according to the Old Testament. The Old Testament is the land is given unto by God. So Exodus chapter 6, I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. You shall know that I am the Lord your God, who has freed you from the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give it to you for a possession. I am, note the words, I am the Lord. It would be wrong, and this is all too appropriate as we're going through the awful Israel-Palestine situation now, it would be wrong to assume that the land was even then empty and freely available. I quote from Numbers chapter 13. And they reported to Moses and said, we came to the land to which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Yet the people who live in the land are strong, and the towns are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the land of the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites live in the hill country. And the Canaanites live by the sea and along the Jordan. That was the promised land, already lived in by other tribal groups. So the Hebrews, Israelites, Jews, had to conquer them. Let me say, this is all, I'm repeating what the Old Testament, the picture it paints. So the boundaries of that land were quite nebulous. It was either a limited patch of land, much like the current boundaries of Israel, or for some it was much, much larger, stretching from the Mediterranean to the Euphrates. Now, when in the demonstrations that are going on, people are shouting from the river to the sea, then I think they're referring to the Jordan. But actually, it might be that they're singing what some Jews believe centuries and centuries ago, the river is Euphrates. That always incorporates the whole of Syria, blah, blah, blah. But the land, so God is the creator, the chosen people, and the land. The fourth concept that weaves its way through the Old Testament is about time. That means it's related to God's overarching plan for the chosen people and his plan for the entire world. This is Isaiah chapter 46. Remember this, keep it in mind, take it to heart, you rebels. Remember the former things, those of long ago. I am God and there is no other. I am God and there's none like me. I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times, what is still to come. I say, my purpose will stand, and I will do all that I please. So, four basic concepts, all the way through the Old Testament: nature of God, the Jews as the chosen people, the land, and time, and God's control of time and history. So all that's by way of background. I'm now going to turn to the Old Testament as a literary artifact. I'm going to say stuff you already know. It's worth remembering the OT is essentially a library of books. But the process of deciding what should be in the library and what should be discarded was not completed or agreed about until either the 1st century BC or, more likely, the 1st or 2nd century AD. So what we see is the Old Testament didn't come together as an agreed collection of books until the time of Christianity emerging. And it could well be it was as the Christians began to formulate what they wanted to have as their scriptures that the Jewish people said, oh gosh, well, we better make clear what our scriptures are. So it wasn't as though Genesis was written thousands of years ago and gradually all the way through. The collection, it was written before, obviously some centuries before, But the collection itself didn't happen either 1st century BC or 1st or 2nd century AD. So, think of it as a library. What's the most significant bookshelf in the library? Answer, that bookshelf which holds the first five books of the Old Testament, called in Greek the Pentateuch. Those books, you'll know, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, also known as the Torah. And the Torah is a word which means direction, guidance, and law. It was believed then, and believed by some still, that those five books were written by Moses himself. So they remain and have the highest status, particularly within religious Judaism. They were written in Hebrew, but as I've already said, Hebrew doesn't include any vowels. There are marks to give you clues. But the interpretation of the meaning is therefore sometimes a matter of debate. So there's those first five books. When were those five books first written down? Almost impossible to say, because they were based upon an earlier oral tradition. But it's generally believed by Old Testament scholars that the process of writing the books of the Pentateuch might have begun in the 6th century BC, might have begun then. That's the writing down of what people had heard and had talked about previously. And in that 6th century, some Jews were in captivity in Babylon. I'll come on to that in a moment. Or some scholars even argue now that that Pentateuch wasn't brought together as a collection until much later, say the 3rd century BC. So I don't know what picture you have in your head of the Old Testament, but I hope you're seeing that actually it was an evolving, gradually evolving process. So let's subdivide the Old Testament. Normally, it's agreed there are four great subdivisions. There's the Pentateuch, the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. The second subdivision is the history. And that, well, who knows how you date it, but the Hebrew conquest of Canaan is thought to be round about 1250 BC. In our terms, late Bronze Age, early Iron Age. Who was living in Canaan at the time? The Canaanites, who were Semitic. So when people accuse you of being anti-Semitic, what's the, are you referring to the Jews or Canaanites or who? Because the Canaanites too were, saw themselves and believed themselves to be Semitic. In other words, some of the descendants of the sons of Noah, Shem in that case. Well, I'll come back to that about the history in a bit. Then, so first lot is the Torah, second subdivision, the history, third subdivision, the wisdom books. For instance, Book of Proverbs, the Book of Psalms, and fourth subdivision, the prophets, including people such as Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Amos. I'm going to add a bit more complexity now. Although there is one book in our Old Testament called the Book of the Prophet Isaiah, most Old Testament scholars suggest that chapters 1 to 39 were written by the original Isaiah, possibly in the 8th century BC. The chapters in Isaiah from chapter 40 onwards were written many years later, perhaps by a school of prophets who regarded Isaiah as their founder, or even by two different individuals, one of whom is sometimes called Deutero-Isaiah, or Isaiah 2, the other one's called Isaiah 3. So, when we read the wonderful poetic passages about the suffering servant at Easter and Good Friday, they're just amazing poetry. Those were probably written by a man whom scholars call Deutero-Isaiah, and he was writing at least 100 years after the original Isaiah. So, four sections, subsections of the Old Testament. The Torah, history, wisdom, the prophets. Here's a question. How many books do the Old Testament contain? I'm not going to look around and ask you for the answer. But actually, you may be surprised to know that in the Orthodox branch of Christianity, they believe the Old Testament consists of 49 books. They think it also has an extra psalm, which they call Psalm 151. Our Psalter goes up to Psalm 150. They think some of the extra books were the Prayer of Manasseh, 3 Maccabees, 1 Esdras, and include the Apocrypha. More of that in a moment. So if you're an Orthodox Christian, the Old Testament that you have as an Orthodox will have 49 books in it. Roman Catholics believe it consists of 46 books. Protestants, of whom Anglicans are part of the branch, believe it consists of 39. And Protestants, Anglicans, frequently, not always, but frequently, omit what they call the Apocrypha. Those are books written between the Old Testament and New, the intertestamental period. So, why do Protestants have a different number? Blame Martin Luther. But I say it's all shifting because, I mean, the Bible I use every day has an Apocrypha in it, and in the lectionary quite recently, that what was set for the morning prayer each morning was a book from what we call the Apocrypha. Now, some Protestants are like, but actually it was wonderful. Wonderful, the wisdom of Ben Sira, yes. Wasn't it, Sandy? Absolutely gorgeous. Gorgeous stuff. It's part of the wisdom literature. Why is there this difference? Well, where do I start? The Hebrew Bible was translated into Greek in the 4th, 3rd century by a group of scholars. It was they were Greek speakers, they were Jews, they lived in Alexandria, the place with the greatest library in the world. So they were real scholars. And that Septuagint included the Apocrypha. So when Orthodox Christians, when Jerome started writing the Vulgate, translated from Hebrew into Latin, then he included what Protestants call the Apocrypha. However, there was a Hebrew Bible. I'm very conscious of Catherine sitting here, who would know far more about this than I do. But the Hebrew Bible is a Masoretic text. It doesn't include all of the Apocrypha. So Luther said, I think we ought to follow the older text, which is the Masoretic text, that doesn't have the Apocrypha, therefore Protestants don't. That's oversimplifying it terribly. But I ought to add, although I've been talking about books, to be historically accurate, I should refer to scrolls. The scroll of the first 5 books, the Pentateuch, is still given pride of place in Jewish synagogues. And you'll remember that when Jesus went to his home synagogue in Nazareth, he wasn't handed a book, he was handed a scroll. In contemporary Judaism, the scrolls are kept in a kind of cupboard at what we would call the liturgical east end of the synagogue called the Ark. And that cupboard is often covered with a fine embroidered cloth. It's very, very lovely. So finally, because of the conquest of much of the Middle East by Alexander the Great and his Greek-speaking followers in the 4th century BC, the Pentateuch bit of the Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Greek, middle part of 3rd century BC in Alexandria. The rest of the Bible, Old Testament rather, was translated 2nd century BC. So the Old Testament, from Hebrew into Greek, though still being used in Hebrew, then translated into a number of Latin versions, and then in the 4th century AD, Jerome created a translation from the original Hebrew, the original Greek, and that became the Vulgate. So, to bring us into a context we know, when Jesus and his disciples talked about the scriptures, what they were referring to was the Old Testament, the scrolls of the Pentateuch and the other scrolls kept in their local synagogues. And the early church, when it was part of the Jewish synagogue tradition, also referred to what is now the Old Testament as their scriptures. So I put it starkly. Before the Gospel of Mark was composed, edited, whichever you prefer, in about 60 AD, the first Christians would have relied for their scriptures on the Old Testament. The 27 books of the New Testament, as we now have them, were all written before 120 AD. Okay, so the 27 we now have, all written before 120. However, they were not brought into their final and agreed version, the canon, until the late 4th century AD. So it took the best part of 300 years for our New Testament to be finalised. And the book of Revelation, great debate. Should it be in? Should it be out? What do we think of it? Was it magic mushrooms? Was it vision? What was it? So, great debate whether it should be in or out. And eventually, numbers of councils of churches, sort of great international gatherings, finally decided, late 4th century, this is our collection of books. This is what we're going to call the New Promise, the New Testament, the New Covenant. So, I'm now going to go to the great Advent themes. How are we doing for time? I've been talking for 3.5 hours already. Are we all right for time, Sandy?
We've got another sort of quarter of an hour.
Really?
Yes.
I thought I'd have another two.
As much time as you want, Bishop Chris. I'm just going to stay.
Can I pass those around? Oh, there's a difference. So there you go. So, here we go. So I'm going to come to the great Advent themes now. And you might be interested to know that the idea of a period of time in the church's year called Advent, that didn't exist in the first 3 centuries. So if you said to Mark or Thomas or Luke or whoever, we're celebrating Advent this year, they wouldn't have a clue. That was a much later development. It happened in the 5th century and eventually was universally adopted. So what I'm going to do now is to go very briefly through the first Old Testament reading set for Advent Sunday and the Sundays thereafter. So the first reading you'll have on there, your piece of paper, is Isaiah 64, 1-9. Okay. Oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down, that the mountains would tremble before you, as when fire sets twigs ablaze and causes water to boil. Come down to make your name known to your enemies and cause the nations to quake before you. For when you did awesome things that we did not expect, you came down and the mountains trembled before you. Since ancient times, no one has heard, no ear has perceived, no eye has seen any God besides you who acts on behalf of those who wait for him. I'm not going to read the rest because that will take ages. So, remembering what I said earlier about the book of the prophet Isaiah, this chapter was written by Deutero-Isaiah sometime during the exile. So let me explain the exile, because it's absolutely critical to understanding the Old Testament. But I'm going to go back a bit before I do that. What's called the United Monarchy, the whole of Israel, ruled by a king called David and his son Solomon, That was round about 1000 BC. That then split. So the southern bit, which had its capital at Jerusalem, was called Judah. The northern bit, which had its capital at Shechem, had the other 10 tribes. So two tribes in the south. That was the land of Judah. So from Jerusalem south, the land of Judah, with its tribes. And then north, another, the other 10 tribes, based around Shechem. Now, what happened? This is before we come to the exile. The northern tribes, in the 8th century BC, the 10 northern tribes were captured and then were dispersed. Nobody knows what happened to them. That accounts for all the stories of the lost tribes of Israel. So there are groups in Ethiopia who say we're one of the lost tribes. I met once an Anglican priest from Biafra who said, the Habiru, that's us. You know, we're one of the lost tribes. But nobody knows what happened to 10 of the 12 tribes. Two tribes left, plus the Levites, they were left down in the south in what became called, what was called Judah. So all was going well until 586, 587. Now, exactly as now, there were geopolitical forces really doing a pincer movement on Israel, because Israel was a kind of great thoroughfare. In 586, 587, the Babylonians were the tops, and their king, Nebuchadnezzar II, besieged Jerusalem, sacked it, destroyed Solomon's temple. Terrible physical blow for the Jews of Judah. 10 tribes, you don't know what happened to them. So two tribes left, plus the Levites. Now, it wasn't just a physical blow. It was a profound and awful blow to their understanding of themselves. Had they not been chosen by God? Was he not Lord of Lords? How could they be so ravaged by an enemy? And how could their Holy of Holies be destroyed? Where was God? What would the future hold for them? It was a terrible, terrible forerunner of the 20th century Holocaust. Read that passage that I've just read as though you were in exile from your own country, ripped from everything that means so much to you, your friends, your relatives, your spiritual and religious center, your landscape. And these verses that I've just read, they're a powerful and heartbreaking plea, a cry from the heart of the Jewish people to the heart of God. So why has that survived, that cry? I want to suggest it's because somehow in the heartbreak of the Jews in Babylon, all humans, all of us, can glimpse something of the nature of our common humanity. A piercing ache of loneliness, or the ache of fear, or the ache of meaninglessness. There is an ache, I believe, deep in the souls of all of us, because we are human. We live with the sense, deeply buried, of experiencing an inescapable void, a loss. And yet, the writer of these amazing verses, whoever he may have been, can see two other realities. Firstly, the gap that inevitably opens up as we sin, driving us from God and separating us from each other. Now, if you think visually, think of that fresco by Masaccio of Adam and Eve in the Brancacci Chapel in Florence being expelled from the garden. Adam has his hands over his face, and Eve has got a great aching kind of silent scream. We've been, all of us, is the theology, we've been driven from where we originally belonged. First reality. Second reality, In relation to God, we are the clay, he is the potter, or to use a more human metaphor, we are his children, God is our Father. In short, even though we may experience the depths of alienation, inside the abyss we can sense the presence of God and can plead that God should never forget us. Consider, says Isaiah says to God, consider, we are all your people. And that was written at a time of terrible exile in Babylon, where the loss and distress of the Jewish people is at its sharpest. Yet even there, the prophet says, do not forget what our God is like. Well, second Advent reading, then I better stop and stand it, because I shall go on. But it begins, comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry for her that she has served her term. And it continues down the bottom of the page. Get you up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good tidings. Lift up your voice with strength, herald of good tidings. Lift up, do not fear. And then final verse, he will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms and carry them in his bosom and gently lead those that are with young. Now, I'm sure I'm like you. I cannot read those verses without Handel going round and round and round. And he shall feed his flock. Wonderful music. And the lyricism of the music captures and enhances the lyricism of the poetry. But let's put that into its historical context. Written round about 530 BC, then the Jews in exile in Babylon were beginning to think that they might actually be free before long. Salvation is imminent. Why? Because in geopolitical terms, Cyrus of Persia, the Persian Empire, was beginning to knock on the doors of the Babylonian Empire, and when Cyrus eventually defeated the Babylonians, he promised the Jews that they could go home. Now for me, it's the imagery of this portion of the Old Testament that echoes like sympathetic vibrations in music in the stories of the life of Jesus. So for example, in the wilderness prepare the way of the Lord, written by Deuteronomy Isaiah, possibly, that was picked up by the gospel writers when they were describing John the Baptist. The voice of one crying out in the wilderness, make his path straight, which raises a question. Were the gospel writers consciously looking for verses in the Old Testament which they could use to describe what they thought about Jesus? Or did their knowledge of those Old Testament scriptures lead them to interpret Jesus' life as though somehow, miraculously, his life had been foretold? There's in Isaiah a strong hint about the future, God controlling time. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. The entire landscape, in other words, is going to be changed. Normal time, normal circumstances would be transformed by God. Now, the writer saw this taking place in his own lifetime and used the poetry as a metaphor about when the exiled Jews would be allowed to go back to Jerusalem. And whilst those exiled Jews did return, at least some of them did, but probably not all, in about 530 BC, Christianity reads those same verses in a subtly different way, as referring to a future age in which Jesus himself will bring in the kingdom, when God will break into time. So you'll recall a few minutes ago I mentioned time as one of the dominant threads, the way that history might unfold. Well, it's reading that passage from Isaiah is quite perplexing, but you can see how significant a passage this was for the gospel writers, because it seems to prefigure the stories that Jesus told about himself being a shepherd. What, honestly, just in terms of poetry, what could be more lovingly tender than he will feed his flock like a shepherd, he will gather the lambs in his arms and carry them in his bosom and gently lead those that are with the young. I mean, just imagine a fellow human being writing those words, scratching them on some vellum. Oh, amazing. But isn't that a perfect description of Jesus in the sense that he told a story about a good shepherd? If a shepherd has 100 sheep and one of them's gone astray, doesn't he leave the 99 on the mountains, going in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I tell you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. Sandy, I think I'd better stop there, because I could go on for another 6.5 hours. But is that all right if I stop there and then people can ask questions or make comments?
Yes, that's a good thing. So we'll have time for questions. Do we want a microphone for that, do you think?
Yeah, whatever.
Probably do. I'm your runner then. Does anybody have any questions? Where do we start? Is this now a good opportunity just to say thank you?
Protestant end of the spectrum, you wouldn't regard the Apocrypha as having much to say to you, because it you would argue that it was not part of the original Hebrew text. Other people on the same Christian spectrum would say, well, let me just look at it and read it. And as Sandy and I discovered only a few weeks ago, reading the wisdom literature in the Apocrypha, it is so beautiful that you think, well, why isn't it in there? But most, but not most, some Bibles now include Old Testament, New Testament, and then a section called the Apocrypha. Some people dip into it. In terms of the Anglican Church says it is not canonical literature. In other words, we've not agreed it's part of the Bible, but it may be used for edification. It's a wonderful Anglican song. I love that, because what I love about it is that it's open, it's possible. You know, we have to, I'm going to go off piece now, but I think the whole point, the whole way in which you read the Bible needs to be a relationship between our understanding and what the Bible is saying, and it's that to-ing and fro-ing. Well, what did that mean? What's that about? How does that speak to me, if at all? And then we can get some really hard questions. I mean, there are bits in the Old Testament I haven't dealt with, which are so morally repulsive. You know, the ethnic cleansing, as we would call it, of groups, just repulsive. So how do we deal with that? Or how do we deal with some of the verses in the Psalms? If you look at the Psalms, you'll find that the word enemy crops up with unbelievable frequency. You'll say, well, just a minute, do I feel I have as many enemies as they seem to think they do? I can interpret that as meaning those people who don't like me, or I can interpret it as saying that's what they then said. So that's why I've read the Bible ever since I was a teenager, daily, and I still read it daily, because it constantly challenges me and makes me think, makes me wonder, and I hope it keeps us all humble, because you know, who can know? Ultimately, the relationship with God is a mystery, ultimately, for which we cannot find adequate words, I'm just very grateful that some people, especially, say, Isaiah, has found words which I find hauntingly beautiful. The suffering servant passage is hauntingly beautiful, but I can't get away from them in my understanding of God. So, sorry, Sandy.
No, I think you've actually touched on something that affects all of us as Christians. That I worked with people and prayed with people over the pandemic through morning prayer. And some people saw the violence in the Old Testament and wanted to throw the whole thing out.
Yeah.
What would you say to that?
Well, I agree, some of it is repulsively violent. I find it amoral. On the other hand, the Old Testament also includes suffering servant passages, some of the Psalms, which are so, so beautiful. Just looked at as literature, let alone as spiritual kind of food, that I go back and back and back to them. And it's this, in a sense, it's a kind of humanity writ large. We're all capable of the most appalling behaviour one towards another. There it is in the Bible. And we all sin, there it is in the Bible. So I'm not a biblicist in the sense that I always go back to the Bible, and I can't cope, to be honest, Sandy, I can't cope with people who say, well, the Bible is true, and you say, how do you know it's true? And they say, well, it says so in 1 Timothy or Peter. Just can't cope. So I believe there is truth hidden inside it. It's an astonishing collection of books which continues to challenge us because of its depth and its beauty. And we have to discover our morality out of all of that, but recognize profoundly that it was those scriptures that influenced Jesus.
Yes.
You know, he read the ethnic cleansing bits like we do. And yet he somehow gave a new, not just a new angle, that's trivializing it, a new sense of the depth of the nature of God, which all of us, many of us here, find still absolutely intriguing. So for me, if I'm really put on the spot, I could give up religion quite easily, except for the figure of Jesus. And I just cannot make sense of the world without that person, Son of God, whatever. That's the only way I can make sense of the way the world is and the way I hope and believe it might be in the future.
Thank you. Do you know, throughout your whole talk, you've been bringing up, and you always do, the humanity of us. And it brings us back to that. And I think that's helped me tonight. If we can see our humanity in the readings as they come up, and a part of what you've just said, and we look at our world and think, it's forever thus. But there is a plan, and it is Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's more complicated than some of our brothers and sisters will have us believe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And we just have to hold on to it, don't we?
Yeah. Sorry,
well, hold on.
Well, nobody will hear you if you don't say
no.
That.
Okay. I've worked with children for 40 years, and most teachers, I think, would agree with me that children and young people need protecting from parts of the Old Testament.
Absolutely.
Which is what I've done. I've avoided it.
Yes.
But I suppose there comes a time when if their faith is going to grow, they need the opportunity to engage and possibly listen to somebody like you talking about it.
Sure.
But it is a dilemma.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, Val.
My daughter did A-level RS, and I think it was about then that she decided to give up on the whole business of Christianity, because half of the syllabus at that time was Judaism.
Yeah.
And presumably a lot of Old Testament.
Yeah, sure.
And it's a problem.
It's a major problem, I think, for us in our faith, because people assume, you know, if you're a bishop especially, you must believe all this stuff in the sense of believing it word for word. No, I don't. Of course I don't. I'm intrigued by it, I'm mystified by it, I struggle with it, I try to understand it. It has a huge history, and all the time I see it moving towards this figure who I cannot resist and cannot understand, but find deeply enlightening, which is a figure of Jesus. So I hang on to that, knowing that it is a terrible irony that it was out of all that ethnic cleansing and the chosenness, which we find very difficult these days, out of all of that, that this one figure should emerge, who somehow radiates a sense of God's beauty and God's purpose, which I find just mind-blowingly wonderful. But I agree with you, it's really difficult, really difficult.
But it is that very thing that keeps us
absolutely
going.
Absolutely.
It helps to have someone like you say this, doesn't it? Because if this were simple, we might have all given it up 40 or 60 years ago.
Yeah.
There's always more, and there's always a struggle, and it's hard sometimes, but it's beautiful. Can I land with something you look like? There's also something that we invite you to do over Advent, and it's the last two pages of this book. It's the Litany of Reconciliation, and it's very much because of the division in the world and the violence in the world and the things that we see now that are just as they were then that cause us distress. We're all invited to join with the community of the Cross of Nails at noon, every day, every weekday during Advent, just to say to ourselves this litany. My hope is that this group of people, all of us together, every day, noon, saying this, but somehow it transforms us to become more of the peacemakers and the peacekeepers. It changes us, but it also helps us engage with this kind of horror that's, the underbelly of life too, because it exists. So this is for all of us. All of our readings are here. This is for all of us, and it's just to help us to walk through Advent together. So please use these well. And just one more. Thank you so much for this tonight. We have to do this again. Thank you. I understand there's some cake. How do we do this? It would be wrong just to storm the tables after we've been so civilized. Hillary, what would you like us to do?
Well, I'm going to go make tea. I think there's some coffee made. Take a cup of that food. I'm sure that everyone just wants to stand up there.
We are a civilized crowd. Thank you so much. Enjoy. See you later.
This is a sort of thing that we do. It's not, it's a new thing. And we all know that there's all kinds of people that are
used to it. Quick question for you. I did this gentleman out of my